So, you know, this is the kind of stuff that really, that Gerald Horn, in this interview that he did with the Real News Network in 2014, this is the real message that he really gives. And I want to play the entire thing. And because, of course, like the interview, which really goes into his experience personally as somebody who was growing up at those times, when, of course, the African-American struggle was really reaching a, you know, reaching a crescendo and really pushing America forward in a progressive direction. You know, what that was like, and, you know, the kind of people he was working with and the kind of struggles he was engaged in and the kind of, you know, and how those struggles were linked with struggles in other countries. You know, particularly throughout the Third World, where, of course, people were fighting to throw off colonialism and resist colonialism and imperialism and this sort of stuff. He said that had a very profound impact on him, as it had virtually everybody, many people of his generation. And just how important that is for him as an African American. So I'm going to play the interview right now with Gerald Horn, African American historian, who wrote his latest book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, which really unpacked, you know, the American Revolution, and basically how the American Revolution was a counter-revolution for African Americans because it reinforced slavery and entrenched slavery for basically another half century, more than another half century in that part of the world, in North America. And that was the effect that the American Revolution actually had for black people. And this is something that is often overlooked, but he documents it, he does an excellent job talking about it in the book, which I would definitely recommend. But anyway, this is Gerald Horn talking on the Real News Network and from 2014, where he's talking about the internationalism of the African-American struggle. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore. Men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already given and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living. That was Karl Marx in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, written in 1852. In the brains of Americans, perhaps nothing weighs on them more than the mythology of the founding of the Republic. The American Revolution is seen as the beacon of hope, freedom, and democracy. The Constitution, almost a document handed down by God, as were the commandments to Moses. Our guest today challenges much of this narrative, which still penetrates the American national psyche and politics. Joining us today is Gerald Horn. He has published over 30 books. He's the former executive director of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, an author, most recently, of The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the USA, Race to Revolution, U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So you've been exploring this nightmare that hangs over the American psyche for quite some time. But on Reality Asserts Itself, as our viewers know, we usually start with the sort of personal backstory. So then we'll get into some of your work, particularly on your book on the Revolution of 1776. You didn't choose what world you would be born into, nor did any of us. But what world were you born into?
I was born in Jim Crow, St. Louis, Missouri, some decades ago. My parents were from Mississippi. They're both passed away. And I grew up with stories about the horrors of Mississippi, lynching. I recall my mother telling me when I was growing up that when those who were defined as white were coming towards you on the sidewalk, you have to step off the sidewalk and step into the gutter. Certainly you're not supposed to look them into the eye when you're speaking to each other.
What year were you born?
1949. And my parents fled from Mississippi like so many others. Richard Wright, for example, the great novelist, had roots in Mississippi, but wound up in Jim Crow St. Louis, which admittedly was not the hell on earth that Mississippi was, but was no paradise either.
What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
Well, that's an interesting story. The neighborhood I was born into in St. Louis was called Mill Creek Valley. I found it to be a stable, working-class neighborhood near stockyards. But the city fathers thought otherwise, and as often happened in so many cities during that period, the 1950s and 1960s, there was this great project of urban renewal, otherwise known as Negro removal. And we had to abandon that neighborhood for another neighborhood in North St. Louis, where actually now my sister lives in that house, which when we moved into it, it was a mostly white neighborhood, but shortly thereafter, magically, it turned into a mostly black neighborhood.
This is part of blockbusting.
Well, yeah, blockbusting, urban renewal, Negro removal. It's interesting. I'm doing a book now on the black press. Claude Burnett, he was the founder of the Associated Negro Press, and he made some of his early fortune, he's black, through blockbusting. That is to say, after these black Americans started moving into this previously all-white neighborhood, the whites started panicking and began selling their property for a song. He would buy them up and then sell them for a higher price.
We did this story in Baltimore. A journalist named Antero Pietella did a three-part interview with him. He wrote a book that this was entirely deliberate. Like, the real estate speculators were all, this is a planned thing to try to scare the hell out of whites. They would actually sometimes, in Baltimore at least, they'd even buy the houses for black families and then create the rumor that the prices are all going to drop, you have to sell, and of course, we'll, as a favor to you, we'll buy it from you.
Right, right.
What did your parents do?
My father was a truck driver. He was a member of the Teamsters Union, which used to bill itself, maybe still does, as the largest union in the capitalist world. It has over 2 million members. He drove a truck for construction sites, and he was also a cab driver. My mother was a domestic, like so many black women of that era.
And what was the politics in the house? The Teamster politics could be anything, actually. It's kind of...
Well, that requires a multiple answer. I grew up with stories about the Teamsters being influenced by organized crime and looting the pension funds of the workers, including the pension fund of my father, by the way, which left him in terrible straits. But I also grew up in a neighborhood in city St. Louis where the Teamsters were led by a guy by the name of Harold Gibbons, who was actually unique amongst Teamsters leaders because he was a social democrat, believe it or not, in the 1950s and 1960s in Jim Crow, Red Scare St. Louis. Took anti-war positions, took progressive positions on Jim Crow, which is partly how my father came to be a member of that union. So it was a contradictory situation in which I found myself.
Because at the leadership level, the Teamsters had no problem supporting not only war, but Republicans or just about anything else that seemed to be in their immediate interest.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, often quite a militant union when it came to actually wages and working conditions.
They were not afraid to go on strike. And at the end of the day, it's proper to say that the strike is the most potent weapon that a union has to wield. And if a union wields that weapon, that can compensate for a lot of deficiencies.
And the Teamsters had defended their picket lines.
Absolutely. They were well known for being able to use their fists and being able to use baseball bats and bicycle chains. It was a militant union. There's no question about it.
And how much of that did you grow up in? How active was your father in the union?
My father was not very active in the union, but I used to read all the publications which would get mail to our house. That's how I know a lot about this history. Although I have to confess that what I mostly remember about the Teamster publications is they used to publish jokes. And I remember a lot of the jokes. I don't remember too many of the stories.
I've always been kind of intrigued, or trying to understand, I guess is the better way to say it, that when a young black man or woman grows up in America, and the culture, the media, the schools are filled with this Americanism.
Yes.
Yet your parents are telling you stories about Mississippi. Your own experience is an apartheid racist experience. How does that jive with this feeling that I'm also an American? And
well, you know, Du Bois, W.B. Du Bois, the founder of the NAACP, a founder of Pan-Africanism, talked about double consciousness, this contradictory aspect, the two warring ideals in one body, I think was the phrase that he used, which basically encapsulates what you just suggested. With regard to myself, I think that I always took the stories of the so-called American dream with a grain of salt, or a shaker of salt, because it did not correspond with what I knew and what my parents had told me. I think, unfortunately and sadly, for a lot of Black Americans growing up, it can lead to a certain kind of cynicism and a certain kind of despair because they're being bombarded with all this propaganda that points in one direction, the reality points in another direction. It can be quite confusing and quite destabilizing.
Now you're born in 49. It's just after World War II. Mm-hmm. What was your... I grew up, I'm born just a little bit after you are, and I know we grew up with all kinds of stories of World War II. I mean, television was one World War II show after another. Where was your father during the war, and what sense of that did you get growing up?
Well, this is where some of my historical research probably is going to infect my memories. My father didn't fight during World War II. Not because he was a pacifist or an anti-war activist, it was because of his age. He was born, he thinks, because he really didn't know, because oftentimes birth records weren't kept for Black Americans in Mississippi. He thinks he was born in 1898, which would mean that in 1941, when the United States enters the war, he was a bit above the age they were looking for. But since I've done all this historical research, I now know that, interestingly enough, St. Louis, Black St. Louis, was a hotbed of pro-Tokyo sentiment. That is to say that Japan had made an appeal to Black Americans, as many real or imagined antagonists of the United States has done over the centuries.
I'm going to interrupt you here.
Sure.
We're going to really dig into this. And this is actually a pretty good teaser, so you're going to have to come back for the other part.
Sure.
Because we're going to dig into this whole thing of Japan positioning itself as the leader of the fight against white supremacy.
Right.
Right now I want to stay on your story.
Sure, sure, sure.
So
I won't go into... Okay, that's it affects my memory.
We'll get there, but we need to get where
you were then. Sure.
And I know for myself, and I think probably for most, I would say, white North Americans of our generation, you know, I'm born in 51, so mm-hmm. around this period. This was a big deal, World War II narrative. Mm-hmm. You know, we fought for freedom and democracy and all the rest and against mm-hmm. Hitler, and we used to have, as kids, we used to have these songs, you know, against, you know, ridiculing Mussolini and Hitler
sure.
and things. But I had a conversation with Danny Glover, who we both know, and he was telling me when he grew up, World War II was practically off the radar.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, unless you had a family member who was actually fighting, it was kind of not part of your narrative. It was out there somewhere. What was it for you?
Well, I agree. Probably I have more memories of the war in Korea, 1950 to 1953, since I was born after World War II. And I recall an uncle who claimed, he wore a ring that he said he had cut from the finger of a Chinese soldier on the Korean Peninsula. I don't know if that was true or not. My mother was a big supporter of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And I think that affected my memories, or has affected my memories. In fact, my oldest sister was named Mary Eleanor Horn. Eleanor after Eleanor Roosevelt, Mary after, of course, Christian Mary. And I think that suggests the kind of household in which I came into being.
Now, your father is a member of the Union. He wasn't that active.
No.
You growing up in St. Louis, the overall arc of the American narrative, I assume, mm-hmm. is very strong. It's a pretty racist city, as was mm-hmm. Baltimore. Mm-hmm. When do you start to kind of question all of this at a more profound level?
Probably when we were forced to move from Mill Creek Valley to North St. Louis, because it didn't, even at that age, it didn't make sense to me. And then moving to North St. Louis, entering a previously all-white school, because I'd gone to all Black schools up until the age of 10 or 11. And then at that age, entering all white schools and then being subjected to sort of normal everyday Jim Crow by people who basically didn't know any better. So I think that begins to shape
What's
my
What's an concept. Example of that?
Well, you know, the Black scare, that is to say, people getting nervous when you're around, clutching their handbags, or you may know the story of Reggie Jackson, the former baseball player. When he goes to the New York Yankees in the 1970s, he lives in an apartment building on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. He gets on an elevator with his dog, and he tells the dog to sit, and all the white people in the elevator sit down on the floor of the elevator. So, you know, it's sort of the black scare, people sort of intimidated by your presence, nervous about your presence, and then, of course, they might just decide to do a preemptive strike against your presence.
And did they?
Yeah, we got into fights, fracases of various sorts on a racialized basis.
Go back to this idea of Americanism, and at some point, I know, because I know your story, you come to a far more radical analysis of just whose America is this.
Mm-hmm.
Talk us through the arc of getting there.
Well, as you know, during the 1960s, the United States was under a lot of pressure with regard to its Jim Crow practices because it professed to be this paragon of human rights virtue in the battle with the former Soviet Union, and so there was pressure to desegregate. And it was under those conditions that I got admitted to Princeton University, an Ivy League school. And I think when you go to an Ivy League school in the 1960s being black, I think it can either cause you to want to join the U.S. ruling elite or to rebel against the U.S. ruling elite. And I fell into the second category.
Why?
I'm not really sure. I mean, when you say why, I'm trying to contrast myself with my classmates who fell into that other category. And I'm not really sure why they fell into that category and I fell into the category that I did. I'm not sure.
Bob Moses had sort of the same kind of opportunities to go to elite schools and kind of made somewhat similar choice to join the civil rights movement and become an activist. But what is it that tips that? Because obviously the path was clear for you. You could have made a success.
Mm. I don't know. Probably because I was interested a lot in writing and studying history. And as they say in the business world, that's not easy to monetize. And so that probably predetermined my path. Because, as you know, there are lots of starving writers in the United States of America. It doesn't provide that many options.
Who inspired you in those days?
You mean historical figures or day-to-day figures?
Whatever. I mean, is that part of the kind of choices you made?
Sure. I would say, in terms of historical figures, the people you might suspect, Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, figures of that sort. That is to say, black Americans who were intellectuals, who were political activists, who were trying to make a difference, who were trying to radically transform not only this society, but the world. So those were the kinds of people I aspired to be like, who I looked up to, and actually who I've been writing about.
You come of age, not, you know, kind of in the, you grow up in and become of age during the Cold War, mm-hmm. height of the Cold War, but particularly McCarthyism, House mm-hmm. of American Activities. Communism, socialism, even radicalism mm-hmm. is almost akin to being a traitor.
Mm-hmm.
How much effect did the Cold War have on you?
Well, you know, as you probably know, in the black American community, it's a bit different. I mean, certainly that community is affected by the Cold War. But then, as now, the general consensus in the black American community was not so much if you were hard on communism, but whether you were hard on white supremacy. That's what they were concerned about. And if you were hard on white supremacy, then you get a lot of leeway. You get a lot of respect. And I think, obviously, that helps to shape people's consciousness. Now, how people decide how hard they're going to be on white supremacy and what path that's going to take is a separate question.
You got very involved in the movement against apartheid in South Africa.
At Princeton. Most of those student movements in the late 1960s, when I was an undergraduate, a lot of them focused on anti-war movement, anti-Vietnam War movement, focused on bringing black studies departments into universities. For some reason, and I'll have to think about why, we got involved in pressuring the university to divest itself from investments in corporations that had holdings in South Africa. In retrospect, that probably had something to do with the fact that we had a number of students from the African continent who matriculated alongside us. And that was probably the influence that pushed us in that direction. We wound up taking over buildings with regard to that project. And we did quite a bit. And that put me on a track in the anti-apartheid movement. I was active in that movement. Actually, I guess you could say I'm still active in that movement because now I'm I write a lot about Southern Africa, but at the time as an undergraduate, I was an activist. And when I was living in New York in the 70s and in the 80s, I was an activist around the anti-apartheid movement, organizing concerts, raising money for the ANC, African National Congress of South Africa, SWAPO of Namibia, MPLA in Angola, organizing picket lines, demonstrations, all sorts of things.
You've written, just to go back to a comment you made a little earlier about the Cold War wasn't such a big thing in black America, the anti-communism. But you've also written that the civil rights movement, many of the leaders, made a kind of a deal to receive some compromises in exchange for being quite rigorously anti-communist. And there are a lot of blacks involved in the communist movement, and you've written about that. So it wasn't a non-issue.
No, it wasn't a non-issue. I was just speaking on the micro level in terms of being an individual in St. Louis, for example, in a particular neighborhood.
Ordinary public opinion.
Exactly. But yes, I mean, if you look at the figure of W.E.B. Du Bois, he's sacked from the NAACP in 1948, precisely on Cold War grounds. He continues moving to the left, NAACP continues moving to the right and to the center. That was a turning point in the history of black America and the history of the United States as a whole, because interestingly enough, despite what some people may think, the NAACP, which is headquartered, as you know, right here in Baltimore, was not as active as it could have been or should have been on the question of the war against Vietnam, for example. And I've written quite recently that that was a fundamental and profound mistake, because I don't think the leaders recognized that so much of our progress, that is to say black Americans' progress, was dependent upon international public opinion. And international public opinion was quite hostile to the U.S. role in Vietnam. So by putting all their eggs in Washington's basket, in some ways they made a fundamental strategic mistake, which we're still paying for.
And this is when King makes his speech against Vietnam. He talks about, I can't remember if he uses the phrase conspiracy of silence, I think, but essentially that's what he's talking about.
Well, yes, Riverside Church, I think it's April 1967, a scant year before he's assassinated in Memphis in April 1968, he makes that famous speech. And even before then, he was crusading in his own way against the war in Vietnam. But as you know, there's always been this idea of the Faustian bargain that the black American leaders have to make. That is to say, in return for not being subjected to being bludgeoned into submission, they make concessions in order to survive. And as NAACP leaders will tell you, a number of organizations have fallen by the wayside. The NAACP is still standing. So that would be their response if one of their leaders were sitting here.
What would your response be?
Well, I think the price was too steep. Everything comes with a price. And I think that the problem was that the concessions that they made, the compromises that they made, did not put us in a condition, in a situation from which we could advance. Because there are compromises that lead you and leave you with the ability to fight another day so that you can advance, and then there are compromises that leave you in a weakened condition. And I think the compromises they made were in the latter category, not least because we, that is to say black Americans and others, won the right to sit at a lunch counter but did not win the right to have enough in our paycheck to pay the bill, because part of what was going on during the movement against Jim Crow was the crushing of trade unions. Most black Americans are from working class backgrounds, like my parents, for example. And when trade unions were weakened and crushed, that meant that what we might have gained on the so-called race front, we lost on the class front. And as you weigh the equities and liabilities, I think we, in many ways, we came out worse, which is why you hear so much nostalgia, interestingly enough, particularly amongst young people, for the Jim Crow era. Of course, they didn't live through the Jim Crow era like I did, and so therefore their memories of it might be a little hazy. But I think what they're expressing is unease with those compromises, and unease with where those compromises left us. And I think they're also expressing unease with the institutions that had to go under as a result of those compromises.
Okay, we're going to continue this discussion in the next part of our series of interviews with Gerald Horn.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Gerald Horn, African-American historian, talking about the Well, one of the things, of course, talking about his own life and talking about the role that internationalism played in the African American struggle as he was growing up, and you know how he was involved in the solidarity with the ANC in South Africa, with the MPLA in Angola, with the you know, he mentioned the Grenadian Revolution, he mentioned like all these struggles, anti-colonial struggles happening around the world that he was involved in supporting, and how these struggles in many ways supported the African American struggle at home. And I think the way I want to end the show here tonight is by playing an iconic speech by the great civil rights leader and communist W.E.B. Du Bois, talking about socialism and the American Negro. This is one of the iconic speeches he gave toward the end of his life in 1960. He was speaking in Wisconsin, the Socialist Club of Wisconsin, and talking about the role that socialism plays in the in class struggle plays in the struggle for African American liberation, the struggle against racism in the United States. And this is what he had to say. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Ladies and gentlemen, socialism and the American Negro. Democracy has so disappeared in the United States that there are some subjects that cannot even be discussed. The essence of the democratic process is free discussion. There was a time when men were not allowed to talk about universal suffrage, or the education of women, or freedom for Negro slaves. Today, communism is the dirty word, and socialism is suspect. I often refer to my education in democracy. In the little New England town where I was born, we had a high school of about 25 pupils. I entered it in 1880 at the age of 12. As I attended the town meeting annually in the spring, there used regularly to appear one of the dirtiest old men I ever saw. He was fat and greasy, and every year he made a fierce attack on wasting his taxes on a high school. I was always furious. I wondered why the citizens sat silent and let him rant. But they did, and then quietly they voted the money for the high school. There I learned my lesson in democracy. Listen to the other side. In this state, and in our time, occurred one of the worst blows to the democratic process which our nation has suffered. Senator McCarthy succeeded in making America afraid to discuss socialism or to recognize communism as aught but a conspiracy. And this in the state of Robert La Follette. I knew La Follette and his valiant wife. I voted for him for president in 1924. And I saw him give his life fighting monopolized wealth and asking world peace. My own work at the time was trying to secure freedom and equality for American Negroes. For a quarter of a century, I edited a little monthly magazine, The Crisis. And despite opposition, I spoke plainly. I was criticized as being bitter, as seeking not simply political but social equality for Negroes, for favoring the teachings of Karl Marx, and for joining the Socialist Party. These accusations were true. But largely as a result of my work, and the work of others, the Negro made progress toward equal citizenship. Progress, but not complete success. The collapse of the capitalist system after the First World War brought poverty, unemployment, and distress worse than America had ever seen. And then came a surge toward socialism called the New Deal. The nation relieved distress, built public works, helped agricultural trade, encouraged literature and art. It joined the Soviet Union in overthrowing Hitler, Mussolini, and Japan, and informing the United Nations to avoid future war. With the death of Roosevelt came reaction. The United States not only stopped progress toward socialism, but ceased to discuss or study it, and came to regard the object of socialism and communism as a crime. Especially American Negroes, still as a mass, poor and ignorant and sick, were given no opportunity to know the sort of progress the world was making to ameliorate the plight of the unfortunate working people the world over, who were in conditions similar to ours. American Negroes were not socialists. They did not know what communism was doing or trying to do, but they knew that Negro education must be better, that Negroes must have better opportunity to work and to receive a wage which would let them enjoy a decent standard of life. They were victims of disease and drifting into crime. To remedy this, they sought to pattern their life after successful Americans. They must work hard, save money, become employers and property owners and investors. This, they thought, would bring them recognition as American citizens equal to others. But America changed. There was still a chance for some to rise and get rich, but the working classes were no longer generally able to buy land. Their wages did not amount to what they in reality earned, and those handicapped by race prejudice had small chance to overcome poverty and ignorance and disease. A class structure began to arise within the Negro group, which produced haves and have-nots, and tended to encourage more successful Negroes to join the forces of monopoly and exploitation and help victimize their own classes and any other lower classes that were possible. To remedy this situation, thinking Negroes still regarded their first step toward emancipation as being political power. They felt that their present plight was due to the fact that they had never become voting citizens of the country, and their first efforts were toward gaining the real right to vote. The young colored men of 1905, of which I was one, emphasized this. This group meeting at Niagara Falls, Canada, in June 1905, demanded freedom of speech and criticism, manhood suffrage, the abolition of all distinctions based on race, recognition of basic principles of human brotherhood, and respect for the working man. They called themselves the Niagara Movement. And despite violent attack on all sides, met again the next year, 1906, at Harper's Ferry. There they said, "In the past year, the work of the Negro hater has flourished in the land. Step by step, the defenders of rights of American citizens have retreated. The work of stealing the black man's ballot has progressed, and 50 or more representatives of stolen votes still sit in the nation's capital. Never before in the modern age has a great and civilized folk threatened to adopt so cowardly a creed in the treatment of fellow citizens born and bred on its soil. Stripped of verbose subterfuge and in its naked nastiness, the new American creed says, fear to let black men even try to rise lest they become the equals of whites. This in the land that professes to follow Jesus Christ. The blasphemy of such a course was only matched by its cowardice." This was the statement of 1906. The NAACP, organized in 1909, added to the program of the Niagara Movement the realization that the fight for Negro freedom could not be carried on by Negroes alone, but by a national movement which united Negroes and whites. They emphasized the role which prejudice played, a prejudice often unconscious but nevertheless effective. The NAACP made a nationwide fight against the horror of lynching and mob violence, and then more and more began to concentrate on the legal aspects of race discrimination and the fact that the Negro was oppressed because the Constitution of the United States was not being enforced. This fight had unprecedented success and culminated in 1954 in the unanimous decision of the Supreme Court against segregation. But during all this struggle, we knew that something still was lacking. If we hark back to the cry of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, and brotherhood, it was clear that there was not and could not be liberty of individual action under the great industrial organization which was growing up in the world led by the United States. Production in industry and trade involved planning, and planning curtailed liberty. Moreover, our inequality as Negroes was a matter of fact. Negroes, with their ignorance and poverty and sickness, were distinctly below the average of those of their white neighbors who were educated and well-to-do and healthy. Finally, despite all propaganda, we saw democracy failing in America. Fewer and fewer people went to the polls. It was increasingly difficult to know for whom or for what one was voting, and the cost of elections rose to suspicious heights. The election in which Abraham Lincoln became President of the United States cost about $100,000. The election which made Dwight Eisenhower President probably cost more than $100 million. It's possible that it cost twice that. Election expenses today include not only direct bribery, but indirect influences, monopoly, propaganda, and deception. Under these circumstances, the appeal of socialism to all Americans increased. But the answer to the doctrines of Karl Marx and the utopias of Fourier and others was that with human nature as it is, socialism simply would not work. To me, the obvious approach to socialism seemed consumers' cooperation. I tried to plan an organization among Negroes as consumers which would furnish employment, help savings, and bring unity of action. But it was soon evident, as many of my fellow workers warned me from the beginning, that individual action alone could not bring consumers' cooperation, that without the power of the government it would fail. And with government cooperation, it was socialism. My own training in this thought came from my travel. My 2 years sojourned in Germany at the end of the 19th century, where I saw the rise of the Social Democratic Party. My repeated visits to England and France in the first decade of this century. My visits to the Soviet Union in 1926, 1936, and 1949. Then, as a peculiar aftermath of the two world wars and my advocacy of peace, my travel abroad was stopped from 1950 to 1958. In 1958, I was able to make a trip covering 11 months in which I visited Western Europe, Eastern Europe, including the Soviet Union, and the Republic of China. This trip completely transformed my thinking. I started on it believing that socialism was a possible form of government and economic organization and was being carried on successfully in Eastern Europe. That capitalism was also a successful form of organization, and while it might degenerate into fascism and the rule of wealth, nevertheless, it could, as had been proven by Franklin Roosevelt, become a progressive organization. I returned with completely changed ideas. I saw socialism as the most successful form of government today possible in the Soviet Union and in the Chinese Republic. I saw it evolving into communism to an astonishing successful degree. On the other hand, I was frightened. And I am still alarmed at the degeneracy of capitalism and the possibility of it becoming a force so destructive that it cannot be endured. One of my first experiences was in England. I had in London a severe attack of intestinal disorder. A young physician summoned at midnight came and treated me. He made six or more visits within the next few days until he had me completely on my feet. When I asked for my bill, I was told that there was no charge, that his services were paid for by the British government. I reminded him that I was an American, and that in America we were repeatedly informed that socialized medicine in Great Britain was a failure. He smiled. The only cost of my illness was the medicine which he prescribed, and that was less than $5. On the other hand, I found that Great Britain, France, and Holland, and Belgium were countries which for past centuries had built their comfort, their prosperity, and civilization mainly on the free land and materials and cheap labor, partly furnished by their own working class, but mainly by colored people overseas whom they dominated by their colonial empires. In 1858, it was clear that the end of this colonialism was in sight. Already, most of the colonies of Holland had become independent. Britain had lost the Empire of India, and France was fighting in vain to hold North Africa. Yet despite the fact that the colonial organization must end, these three great countries of Western Europe and others like Italy, West Germany, and Portugal were depending for their future life on materials which they underpriced in the world market, on stolen land, and on labor wretchedly underpaid. The political power to carry on this process depended upon the laboring class in Western Europe and America, and that laboring class was being bribed by political power and high wage, which came not so much out of the profits of the employers as out of the low wages of colored labor. I did not sense in Western Europe, and certainly I had not seen in America, any disposition so to improve the organization of work and the distribution of income as to make any essential change in the present capitalist system. On the other hand, I was astonished and encouraged by what I saw socialism doing. Not only did I see the results of socialized medicine in England and progress in housing, health, and workers' pensions in Sweden, Holland, Belgium, and France, but in the Soviet Union and East Germany, I saw a change of attitude toward the masses of people, not as the wards and beneficiaries of the rulers of the nation, but as the main body which itself owned the nation and for which the nation existed, and as the reservoir out of which were being recruited those people who were making civilization. In China, it seemed to me that the process was going even further, and that human nature was being so changed that instead of self-seeking and class hatred, which so characterized the West, that there was coming a sense of partnership in a vast and growing nation, of willing cooperation, and of a widespread content and happiness, which I had not seen elsewhere in the world. All this was my deep and firm impression. I cannot prove it, particularly not to you who have been poisoned by lies and distortions for 10 years. After all, I saw these countries only partially and for brief visits, yet I am a traveler of some experience, and I know personally the trials of the poor and despised. I was given unusual opportunity for observation, and thus my conclusions are of some value. I saw the spread of socialism and communism. Today, more than half the people of the world live under a socialism which is growing toward communism. In my mind, there is no doubt but that the world of the 21st century will be overwhelmingly communistic. Returning now to the United States, I look again upon the scene. The legal fight led by the NAACP has been an astonishing success. But its very success shows the limitations of law and law enforcement unless this program has an economic foundation. Unless the mass of Negro people have not simply legal rights, but have such rights to work and wage that enable them to live decently. Here in the United States, we have had a stirring of the Negro population which emphasizes these facts. In the slave South, Negroes impoverished and mistreated have sought remedy by pouring into the cities of the South, and especially into the great cities of the North. They have caused problems of housing and of crime, of poverty and disease. It spells the damnation of youth and death of children and degradation of women. Through this, the American Negro is passing. It emphasizes our national problem of gambling and prostitution, drug using, and murder and suicide. On the other hand, the Negroes who have grown in intelligence and awareness of their handicaps have begun to fight back by the use of the boycott and the passive resistance, the experience in Montgomery, the extraordinary uprising of the students all over the South and beginning in the North shows an awareness of our situation which is most encouraging. But it still does not reach the center of the problem. And that center is not simply the right of Americans to spend their money as they wish and according to law, but the chance for American Negroes to have money to spend because of employment by which they can make a decent wage. What then is the next step? It is for American Negroes in increasing numbers and more widely to insist upon the legal rights which are already theirs, and then to add to that increasingly a socialistic form of government, an insistence upon the welfare state which denies the further carrying out of industry for the profit of those corporations which monopolize wealth and power. The stopping of a government of wealth, for wealth, and for wealth, and the returning of governmental power to the individual voter with all the freedom of action that can be preserved, along with an industry carefully organized for the good of the masses of people and not for the manufacture of millionaires. Does capitalism offer such a program? It does not. It offers war. We have gone insane with the idea that the world is going to be ruled by physical force. More than any other nation on earth or in time, we are spending fantastic sums of money to prepare for war and basing this necessity of war preparation on dislike and distrust and contempt for most of the human beings who inhabit the world. We have no peace movement in the United States that deserves the name. We have almost no men of intelligence and prestige who dare speak up for peace. Cowed and silent, we face immeasurable catastrophe. And the first duty of Americans is to realize this fact. To illustrate what I'm trying to say, let me remind you of certain occurrences in recent times. On October 27, 1951, 8.5 years ago, Collier's Magazine, a flamboyant pictorial with a circulation claimed to be 1.5 million, published a number in which the leaders of American science and literature made contributions. At a time when few socialists in the United States dared open their mouths and many were in jail, when economics and social science were being taught in institutions like this with the utmost caution, and when I was being handcuffed for advocating peace with the Soviet Union, this extraordinary magazine was on every newsstand and on radio and television. It predicted and described in 130 pages the aggressive war of the United States against the Soviet Union, and the editors and contributors said that this year, 1960, would see the utter destruction of communism the world over and the victorious American troops walking in the streets of Moscow. Who wrote these words and made these prophecies? The editors say, and I quote, "This historical report was written by many of the West's top historians political, economic, and military experts, commentators, and artists. Among them were Alan Nevins, described as one of the foremost American historians, Stuart Chase, Edwin R. Murrow, Robert Sherwood, J.B. Priestley, and Margaret Chase Smith. Senator Smith wrote on America's, on Russia's rebirth, which she pictured as being accomplished by American soldiers, presumably like those then raping Korean women and burning children alive in Korea and dropping disease germs on China. For myself, I knew these writers were wrong. I had been in the Soviet Union in 1826, in 1926 and in 1936. In 1949, 25 Americans were invited to attend a Soviet Peace Congress with expenses paid. I was the only one who accepted. I addressed a cross-section of that great nation. I did not, as I would have been justified in doing, devote this opportunity to describing the plight of my people. On the contrary, I contended that I was speaking for those Americans who did not want war, and that they were a majority of the nation. No one visiting the Soviet Union at that time could for a moment doubt its peaceful intentions. The reply to my thesis was this extraordinary article, which broke all rules of international decency, told lies and spread information, and yet was received with applause in most quarters and unforgivable silence in others. The year 1960 has come and is over a third gone. What has happened? Collier's magazine is dead. Its vaunted 1.5 million readers have ceased to subscribe because the reduced prices, which they charge for Collier's and a dozen other flashy periodicals, which are thrust down our throats, are not needed by the publishers, save as bait to advertisers who pay millions to make you buy their goods. The day will come, I suspect, when Life and Look will pay their subscribers to allow the use of their names. American troops are not in Moscow and are not planning to be there. But the President of the United States is going, and we hope on an errand of peace to which he has been graciously invited by the head of the Soviet state in one of the greatest speeches of our day. On the other hand, there are signs in this nation which should give us pause. There is stealing, cheating, poisoning, gambling, and killing to a frightening degree. Our exports do not pay for our imports, and we are settling the deficit by exporting $4,000 million of our hoard of gold in the past 2 years. Unemployment among our workers, despite our desperate efforts to conceal the truth, is far too high. Adulteration of food and overpricing of medicines have reached alarming heights, and the cost of living is continuously rising. Perhaps our most unforgivable deed today is our attitude toward China. Historically, in America, chinks have always rated below wops and niggers. Negroes were lazy and jolly, and this infuriated the slave drivers. But Chinese coolies worked like dumb, driven cattle. They were valuable because they worked hard for almost nothing. During the 19th century, they were not only worked at home, but were transported in droves overseas like slaves to work for white folk. When they showed signs of rebellion in China, we began to steal their land and make them buy opium, and we planned to distribute the Chinese empire among the superior white nations. America willingly agreed, so long as we got equal entry through this open door. The Christian world sent droves of missionaries to make Chinese submission quick and easy. Then, just as we were stretching our claws to pluck the rich fruit of the white man's burden, Sun Yat-sen led the last revolt. The Soviet Union helped him, and Chiang Kai-shek came forward to assume leadership. Our way was clear. Despite the advice of our own General Stillwell, we bribed Chiang to betray and murder the communists. We gave him money and arms. And yet, with desperate determination, China won its independence and drove the murderous traitor into the sea, where he still squats on an island protected by our guns and money. We hate China. We propose never to forgive the Chinese. We count them outside humanity. We charge them with every crime we can invent. I was on the borders of Tibet last year when China saved the Tibetan slaves, and we shed crocodile tears. We have sympathy and money for the slave drivers who hold the Dalai Lama as prisoner. But for the prisoners in our own overcrowded jails, who rebel each day and cry in vain for justice and mercy, our only remedy is more jails. This shows the increase in our religion. This shows why we tax Americans into crime, poverty, and suicide, and spend 10 times more for war than for education, health, and social security. Our national debt for war is greater than possibly we ever will or can pay. This nation tries to prove its prosperity by balancing monopolized wealth of the owners of great corporations against the poverty of our lower third. What does this call for? Not a compulsory rush into socialism. Many of us believe and hope that socialism will and must come to this land. We see no other way. But scores of others do not believe this, and that is their right. They have, however, no right to prevent the truth about socialism from being told. They have no right to prevent students from studying the remarkable philosophy of Karl Marx. They have no right to prevent Americans from traveling in China. Especially Americans of eminence must stop the spreading of lies about the socialist world. A few years ago, I was invited to the Harvard Club of New York to hear a former president of Harvard lecture on socialist education in the Soviet Union. I was loath to accept because no Harvard club has ever admitted a Negro to membership. But it was my duty to go. Knowledge always costs something, and this is the kind of currency I have often had to pay in order to know. President Konert, former commissioner of Germany, and largely responsible for present conditions there, told his audience that after 2 visits to the Soviet Union, he had been unable to learn on what basis of examination Russian students were graduated from the high school into the university. Now, on his return to America, he had learned the truth. The Soviet Party had refused to allow students to be examined in order to promote only followers of the party. He had hardly got his mouth closed before Sputnik had crossed the heavens and the back of the moon had been photographed, proving beyond doubt the leadership of a communist state in modern science. The superiority of the Soviet Union in the education of children became indisputable, and her lead in industry seemed soon inevitable. America must let youth know. American students must dare to study the Soviet Union and China as carefully as they study Great Britain and France. But especially, American Negroes must know what is going on in the world today and learn for themselves what this has to teach them in order that they may preserve their culture, get rid of their poverty, ignorance, and disease, and help America live up at least to a shadow of its vain boast as the land of the free and the home of the brave. Remember how Browning once sang, "Oh, to be in England now that April's there."